Caprior goes into government and investigates the humor of the profession with the help of Alfred Marx.
I knew a bloke who had two sons. One was a politician, the other one wasn't too much good either. A politician's wife was expecting a baby, and the doctor from the maternity hospital rang her husband. Sir, may I be the first to congratulate you? You're the father of triplets. What? I demand a recount! Another politician rings up his wife after his great success. Darling, I've won the nomination.
Honestly?
Why on earth did you have to bring that up? All parliamentary debates are reported in the official journal, Hansard. If you look in the index, you will find the following. Seats. See under members. A surgeon, an architect, and a politician were arguing as to whose profession was the oldest. The surgeon said, Eve was made from Adam's rib, and that surely was a surgical operation. Maybe, said the architect, but before that, order was created out of chaos, and that was an architectural job. But, interrupted the politician, somebody created the chaos first. Speaker's Corner, Hyde Park.
When our party gets into power... You see that Rolls Royce there down Park Lane? You, comrade, you'll be driving that Rolls Royce.
I'm not going for bus.
You see that big fat cigar that Capricious is smoking? When our party gets in a power, you'll be smoking one of them.
I'm not the fans.
And comrade, you see that big hotel there in Park Lane? When our party gets in a power, you can live there.
I like living in this council house.
When our party gets in a power, you'll do as you're bloody well told.
Whenever anything goes wrong, the immediate reaction is, let's all blame the government. And the work of its leaders is one of the traditional butts of humour. In every country, we're telling jokes about the government isn't punished. Politicians are ridiculed unmercifully by every pub wit in the country. Perhaps people feel that one of the rights of democracy is to make fun of their elected rulers. Or perhaps they just resent government by people who don't seem so different from themselves. Robert Louis Stevenson.
Politics is perhaps the only profession for which no preparation is thought necessary.
Politics has never commanded much respect and has been ridiculed in cartoons, plays, and every medium of entertainment. The very word politician has overtones of duplicity. In fact, the first meaning given in the OED is
a politic person, especially a crafty intriguer.
Much of the humour of politics is specifically tied to a particular time and place. Political cartoons and other topical jibes soon lose their comedy and retain only historical interest. But there's a great body of abuse that doesn't seem to date. Here's a conversation between Boswell and Dr. Johnson. So, sir, you laugh at schemes of political improvement.
Why, sir, most schemes of political improvement are very laughable things.
Laughable, yeah, but necessary. I mean, ultimately, it's the necessity of government that most people seem to resent. Tom Paine.
Government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil. In its worst state, an intolerable one.
We don't live under government, possibly in its worst form, but most people still find something to grumble at. At least I assume that's the case, so you can be never sure of any political issue without the help of an opinion poll.
What kind of government does this country want, and how do we go about getting it? Well, it was to answer questions like these that my colleagues and I recently organized a nationwide Gallup poll. And the results from this showed that from a cross-section of the public who were questioned, 1% said yes, 2% said no, 48% didn't know, and 49% didn't want to know. Now, this didn't seem very satisfactory, so we decided to question other cross-sections of the public who weren't quite as cross as the first section. It was agreed that the range of people interviewed should be as varied and interesting as possible. I myself personally questioned several thousand young ladies whose ages ranged from 18 to 20.
Well, say, that's right to you.
They were very varied and extremely interesting. 66% said no. Slapped my face. And 20% called the police. Yes, and 1% said yes, without any questions being asked.
Peter Sellers. In this country, we suffer, or profit, according to how you look at it, from party politics. Dr. Johnson again.
I would not give half a guinea to live under one form of government rather than another. It is of no moment to the happiness of the individual.
But not everyone would agree with him. If he was right, then politicians have spent many years of wasted breath slinging mud at each other. Few have made their attacks with more elegance than Benjamin Disraeli.
A conservative government is organized hypocrisy.
Or again?
Conservatism discards prescription, shrinks from principle, disavows progress. Having rejected all respect for antiquity, it offers no redress for the present and makes no preparation for the future.
Here's an opposing view from a letter in the Peeblesshire News.
Socialist government consists in the application of socialist principles, while conservative government subsists or ought to on the application of divine law.
To clarify the party political system, perhaps we should turn to Gilbert and Sullivan's Iolanthe.
When all night long a chap remains on sentry, go to chase monotony. He exercises all his brains, that is, assuming that he's got any. Though never nurtured in the lap of luxury, yet I admonish you, I am an intellectual chap, and think of things that would astonish you. I often think it's comical, fa-la-la, fa-la-la. How nature always does contrive, fa-la-la, that every boy and every girl that's born into the world alive is either a little liberal, a little conservative. Fa-la-la, fa-la-la, is either a little liberal or else a little conservative. MPs divide, if they've a brain and a cerebellum too, they've got to leave that brain outside and vote just as their leaders tell them to. But when the prospect of a lot of dull MPs in close proximity, all thinking for themselves, is what no man can face with equanimity. Then let's rejoice with a loud fa-la-la, 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 that nature always does contrive, fa-la-la-la. That every boy and every girl that's born into the world alive is either a little liberal or else a little conservative. Fa-la-la, fa-la-la, is either a little liberal or else a little conservative.
and then along came Labour. That was Kenneth Sandford in fine tonsil. One of the main objections to party politics is that the different parties don't offer very real alternatives. Alexander Pope.
For forms of government, let fools contest. Whate'er is best administered is best.
True. Very true, Alfred, isn't it? But that doesn't make the voter's decision any easier. It often seems that he's choosing the lesser of two almost identical evils. Perhaps we need someone to come up with a really new political party.
If there's one thing I can't bear, it's when hundreds of old men come creeping in through the window in the middle of the night and throw all manner of garbage all over me. I can't bear that. I think that's unbearable. Ghastly old men with great pails of garbage throwing it all over me. I don't think it should be allowed. I think there should be a place for those people to go. I don't think it should be my room. I'd vote for any party that would say I won't allow people to throw garbage all over me, but none of the parties seem to be particularly interested. That's why I formed the World Domination League. It's a wonderful league, the World Domination League. The aims, as published in the manifesto, are total domination of the world by 1958. That's what we're planning to do. We've had to revise it. We're hoping to bring a new manifesto out with a more realistic target. How we aim to go about it is as follows. We shall move about into people's rooms and say, "Excuse me, we are the World Domination League. May we dominate you?" Then if they say get out, of course we give up. There's been some wonderful... well, you have to give up once you've been told to get out. I've had a new manifesto printed, which should boost our programme a bit. There's a picture of me on the cover with the words, "I will dominate you," at the top of it. It's a very compelling picture, and I think there's a good chance of my doing a bit of dominating soon. I've had some wonderful ideas for getting the dominating going. I've got some extremely subtle advertising slogans that should get the public behind us. Things like, "Vote for E.L. Wistie, and lovely nude ladies will come and dance with you." It's a complete lie, of course, but you can't afford to be too scrupulous if you're going to dominate the world. Then there's another good one which says, "If you don't vote for E.L. Wistie, horrible black spiders with hairy legs will creep into your room in the middle of the night and bite your ears off." That should get the women's vote, because one thing they can't bear is black spiders grabbing hold of them in the night.
Peter Cook, but how do politicians go about their business? We can piece together some of the workings of Parliament from the press and other sources. Here's an extract from a lecture. It was on parliamentary procedure by Sir Edward Campbell.
The first business of the day is prayers. The chaplain stands up with the speaker next to him. The chaplain looks at the members of Parliament and then he prays for the country.
After that, the business of the nation is discussed with all the skill trained minds can bring to it. From the Oxford Mail.
Mr. Ernest Brown crystallised the unemployment problem when he told Parliament that it was really a question of finding jobs.
Then follows the lively cut and thrust of political debate. The Daily Telegraph.
"People need not be surprised at a good deal of sleeping going on in the House of Commons," said Sir George Hume, MP, at a meeting last night in Greenwich. "You'll get weary at times, and in the atmosphere of the House, it's very difficult to keep awake," he said. "But the public do not seem able to appreciate our difficulties. Some of the best members are the silent ones."
And who would disagree? Once Parliament has made the decisions, it's up to civil servants to implement them. Now, there are a lot of cruel jokes about civil servants. Some of them take this sort of form. Alfred, what about your brother who was trying so hard to get into the civil service? What's he doing now?
Nothing. He got the job.
Civil servants also reckon to be over-influenced by the red tape, rules and regulations.
A man walked into a public assistance office, picked up a chair and smashed 8 windows, while 3 civil servants just stood by and watched, the court was told yesterday. The officials explained that they were not allowed to lay hands on anyone seeking assistance.
That was in the Daily Mirror. The top civil servants work closely with their ministers and prepare statements and investigate claims. This is from the Daily Mail.
From today, the price of rice and rice products will be increased slightly, but there will still be none in the shops, said the Minister of Food.
Non-inflation for you. And from the Esher News.
An appeal against Esher Council's refusal to allow an illuminated sign at Hurst Service Station, East Moseley, has been allowed by the Minister of Housing and Local Government, subject to certain conditions. One is that the sign shall not be illuminated.
It's splendid stuff, isn't it? It makes you glad to think that the politicians are hard at it, you know, once you've elected them. Though it's strange, the only time the general public see much of them is just when they're seeking election and addressing the inevitable public meetings.
My friend, in the light of present-day developments, let me say right away that I do not regard existing conditions lightly. On the contrary, I have always regarded them as subjects of the gravest responsibility and shall ever continue to do so. Indeed, I will even go further and state quite categorically that I am more than sensible of the definition of the precise issues which are at this very moment concerning us all. We must build, but we must build surely.
No.
Let me say just this. If any part of what I am saying is challenged, then I am more than ready to meet such a challenge. For I have no doubt whatsoever that whatever I may have said in the past or what I am saying now is the exact, literal, and absolute truth as to the state of the case. I put it to you that this is not the time for vague promises of better things to come. For if I were to convey to you a spirit of false optimism, then I should be neither fair to you nor true to myself. But does this mean, I hear you cry, that we can no longer look forward to the future that is to come? Certainly not.
What about the workers indeed, sir?
Grasp, I beseech you, with both hands, the opportunities that are offered. Let us assume a bold front and go forward together. Let us carry the fight against ignorance to the far corners of the earth. Because it is a fight which concerns us all. And now finally, my friends, in conclusion, let me share just this.
Peter Sellers. Magnificent piece, certainly. Reminding me very much of the old joke of a man meeting a friend coming off of a political platform. Hey, what's going on in there? He asks.
Prospective candidates talking.
Yeah, what about?
He didn't say.
It's at that sort of meeting that politicians are liable to the attack of hecklers. Sometimes the politician has the last word, sometimes he doesn't. I want industrial reform. I want agricultural reform. I want housing reform. I want
chloroform!
Mr. Chairman, I must complain. I have been on my feet for 10 minutes, but there's been so much ribaldry and interruption that I can hardly hear myself speak.
Don't worry, mate, you ain't missed much.
But the circus-like atmosphere of public meetings is a necessary step for those who aim for the highest office in the land. You've got to be tough to make it. Unlike Hilaire Belloc's Lord Lundy, who was very prone to tears.
It happened to Lord Lundy then, as happens to so many men. Towards the age of 26, they shoved him into politics. in which profession he commanded the income that his rank demanded, in turn as Secretary for India, the Colonies, and War. But very soon his friends began to doubt if he were quite the man. Thus, if a member rose to say, as members do from day to day, rising out of that reply, Lord Lundy would begin to cry. A hint at harmless little jobs would shake him with convulsive sobs. Well, as for revelations, these would simply bring him to his knees and leave him whimpering like a child. It drove his colleagues raving wild. They let him sink from post to post, from 1,500 at the most to 8 and barely 6, and then to be curator of Big Ben. And finally, there came a threat to oust him from the cabinet. The Duke, his aged grandsire, bore the shame till he could bear no more. He rallied his declining powers, summoned the youth to Brackley Towers, and bitterly addressed him thus, "Sir, you have disappointed us. We had intended you to be the next Prime Minister but three. The stocks were sold, the press was squared, the middle class was quite prepared, but as it is, my language fails. Go out and govern New South Wales." The aged patriot groaned and died, and gracious, how Lord Lundy cried.
Not only does a politician need grit and toughness and the ability to stifle his tears, he also needs votes. I mean, that's how the system works. George Bernard Shaw said,
"Democracy substitutes election by the incompetent many for appointment by the corrupt few."
Well, whether or not that's true, after an election, a politician's whole career depends ultimately on the man who counts those votes.
Three, not him. 4,278,391. What? 4,278,392. What? 4,278,393. 4,208,394. We're getting on, notice. 4,278,395. 4,278,396.
Cup of tea, sir.
What?
Cup of tea for you, sir.
A cup of tea. That's good, a cup of tea. I love a cup of tea. Well, that's better. Nothing like a good cup of tea. Nothing like a good cup of tea, I say, Mrs. Fern.
There was nothing like a good cup of tea.
Oh, I suppose so. Now then, let me see now then. Where is I now?
Spike Milligan, with a brief interpolation from Harry Secombe. The Houses of Parliament sometimes seem a bit remote. We are made aware of the major developments in national government, but often we are more immediately concerned by the conduct of local government. Here again, the system is dependent on democratic elections.
The councillor F.W. Nash of Castle Rising, Norfolk, has been returned unopposed to the seat on Friedrich Lynn Council, which had been declared vacant on the grounds that he'd not attended meetings regularly.
That was in the old Daily Herald. Another from another defunct newspaper, the News Chronicle.
The parish council at Woodville, Derbyshire, have ordered a street lamp to be moved because it sheds more light in the neighbouring district of Swadlincote than it does in Woodville.
Oh, those local councils have some tricky problems to deal with. The Sun.
Council workmen are to rip planks out of seats and make holes in the walls of bus shelters in an attempt to make the shelters too uncomfortable for hooligans. Councillor Harry Bill said, something has got to be done to stop the wrecking of the shelters. As far as I can see, this is the only way.
We can feel confident that local affairs are in safe hands. And so are national affairs, if we are to believe the party political broadcasts.
Good evening. I'm here tonight to talk to you on a purely non-political, non-partisan Labour Party basis. I am the Chancellor of the Exchequer, so there. Now, a lot of people have been saying recently that our economy is in really bad shape. Really? Yes. Bad? Yes. Shape? Perhaps. But really bad shape? Now then, let's get down to brass tacks. The brass tacks, which I shall be imposing on, is an expedient necessity. It is essential at this time, when our beloved country has its back to the wall, that we realize how heartening that can be. Only with one's back to the wall can one go forward to the next war. People often come up to me in the street, which is in itself encouraging. They say, look here, smarty pants. And let us not forget, look here, smarty pants is what democracy is all about. Look here, what about the pound? A fair question. A good question. And one that I intend to dispense with altogether tonight. I put the issues squarely before you. One, the pound is stable. The horse may have gone, but the pound is dead. Two, I wouldn't be doing this job if I weren't a trained economist and mathematician. Five, my policy is one of non-alignment. I will not see Britain's money spent on your behalf. Six, the Prime Minister is behind me. Always. Seven, the trade index for the last fiscal year shows a trend that can only be described. And eight, figures prove nothing. That is why I say to you, this is a time for you and I and him to tighten our belts, pull up our socks, square our shoulders, and try and relax. Every one of you can make some contribution. I shall be giving you the address later. Now may I conclude by saying, I laugh at those who say this country is struggling. Ha ha ha. We can turn the corner, if only we can find it. We will confound the Jonas, the backsliders, the dismal Jimmies, and the rest of our great people, and prove to the world that there are bigger, better, greater crises ahead. Good night.
Ronnie Barker. Well, that was the last of this series of investigations into the humour of the professions. We hope you've enjoyed them. So from Alfred Marks and me, goodbye.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's for home?
Frank Lior Goes Into Government was produced by Simon Brett and Bob Oliver Rogers.